And flowers, hills and forest weep to feel your breath's sweet motion. Eyelids hot with tears, your gentle breezes cool. Oh, must I perish, or may I still hope to see him yet again, the hope I cherish? Hasten to my darling, bring these words to him, but soothing, healing, for he must not grieve. Speak gently to his heart, my pain concealing. Say, but say it mildly, wisely. I am living if he loves me. I shall have love, joy, and life when all of these his presence gives me.
Marina Warner is a cultural historian, critic, and novelist.
This Mariana von Willemer, she is one of many women in Goethe's life who acts as a truly blazing catalyst of his inspiration. Mariana then embarked on a kind of series of dialogue poems. It's slightly contested whether she did actually author them, but she certainly, they enacted them together. They took on Islamic personalities. He called himself Hatem. She called herself Zuleika. The origin, actually, of Zuleika Dobson, it's exactly the same idea, the sort of glorious siren.
So that's Zuleika, so that's dodgy, isn't it? Where does that come from?
It's when Joseph is in Egypt, and Potiphar's wife is the head of an official in Pharaoh's court, and she fancies Joseph, and she pursues him, and when he runs from her, because he's so chaste and good, he leaves his coat behind, and then that she's tested. When she accuses him, she's tested. And she's come down to us in the West and tradition as an example of female deception, guile, and lust. But in the Quran, the story is wonderfully changed, and Goethe liked this. It appealed to his ethic. He liked a permissive ethic. And what happens is that Zuleika says, I was smitten, and I have behaved, and I have done this thing. But I want you to look at him and see how you feel. So she invites her women friends, and she asks Joseph to come, and she gives them fruit to eat. And when he comes, the young women are so smitten by his beauty that they cut their hands with their fruit knives. And this is illustrated. You can see it sometimes illuminated in beautiful Persian manuscripts. And what's interesting about this Quranic episode is that it tallies with a lot of the poetry, and also with the Arabian Nights, for example, in that women's desires matter. People, they're not actually expected to quell them. They're expected to channel them. But it's actually acknowledged that they have them and that they are very powerful, dramatic forces in the world of experience. And Goethe liked that, and he gives expression to that.
It is wonderful the way his Zuleika completely inverts the Western idea of the treacherous woman. And as you say, appeals to this kind of permissive sensibility that Goethe has. Just leading on from that, what extent do you think Goethe links the sensual with the divine? So I think Nahatim's love for Zuleika as an expression of love for God.
Well, Zuleika herself becomes a saint in the Islamic pantheon. And he does have a poem in which he invokes four great women, including the Virgin Mary, Fatima, Muhammad's daughter.
Women nothing need forego, hope let purest faith declare, yet of only four we know certainly who entered there. First Zuleika, light of earth, seeking Joseph delectation, now in Eden bliss rebirth, gleaming gem, renunciation. Then the ever-blessed maid, from the heathen's healing born, she in bitter grief betrayed saw her son on cross forlorn. Next Mohammed's wife and aid brought him splendour from above, and a testament she made, one Lord God, one spousal love. Fatima's kind, guileless role, daughter, wife, no flaw she had, purest her angelic soul, honey-golden, beauty-clad. These the four we view in grace, who with lady praise we please, merits in that Eden place, heaven favour too from these.
Goethe adopted the sensuality of Persian poetry to address his beloved. But another theme of the divan, borrowed from Eastern literature, and from Hafiz in particular, is that of dissidence and antipathy for those who frown on the pleasures of life, such as wine and sex. Hafiz's poems give short shrift to those who advocate a version of extreme Islamic asceticism, and Goethe is similarly scornful of such puritanism. Don't kiss anything except the sweetheart's lip and the cup of wine, Hafiz, friends. It's a grave mistake to kiss the hand held out to you by a Puritan.
You know, he's never pious. So in a sense, he's always trying to draw from the objects that he addresses some kind of experience that I would say is of knowledge of the world. I mean, he's not really metaphysical. It's physical, and that's why he's interested in, you know, he was a mineralogist, he was a meteorologist, he wrote a book on colour. I mean, he is that ect-romantic grappler with the grain of sand.
He's looking back to Hafiz, who he admired as something of an awkward customer, I think, a rebel. To what extent does Goethe's divan tackle these themes of dissidence and unorthodoxy?
Well, the book is organised in a complex way. It's very long. It's a whole huge lyric cycle in 13 books, and they vary in tone. It would be a mistake to give the impression that they're all lyric songs and love songs. There are epigrams, there are political squibs, there are philosophical meditations on the meanings of the names of plants or the names of stones. I mean, he takes a lot of his polymathic interest into the poem, but also a lot of his disgust and his distaste and his sense of himself as awry and as not fitting in and as being, you know, always in the heterodox position and kind of relishing it, but at the same time disliking that he's not more honoured, I suppose. And he sees Hafiz as totally his precursor. I mean, this is another aspect in which he becomes his twin, because Hafiz lived under a tyrant, Tamerlane, Timur, the invader. So for Goethe, this was a kind of avatar of Napoleon, who was causing havoc in Germany, and was only just defeated when the cycle begins. And he also, Hafiz, lived under a period of excessive religious puritanism. And several of the epigrammatic mordant, very sharp lapidary poems in the West East Divan are attacks on religious hypocrisy and excessive Tartuffe-like religious behaviour.
That wine is from eternity, this I question not. That it might a pre-angel creation be, may also well be taught. The drinker, whatever the case may be, looks God in the face, the freer he.
I mean, in the context of Persian and Arab poetry, wine and women, I mean, this is the main subject, basically. You even have that in Abu Nuwas' poetry, a poet from the 8th century in Baghdad. And Goethe, I think, was a very similar character. I mean, he was getting wine from all over this region. Yeah. You know, he was a famous drinker.
Yeah, he was, yes. Really, he wanted to live, and I admire that, yes.
In Germany today, the spirit of Goethe's divan lives on. In Weimar itself, there is a divan restaurant, which serves Persian food and where you can read the texts of poems by Goethe and Hafiz, which decorate the walls. Rita Seifert is a writer and archivist from Weimar.
We have this little cafe, and it's called Divan. This is the German pronunciation. And you go to the little courtyard and you can leave the other world of Weimar behind you, and you can step in into this little part of Orient. And a couple of years ago, a group of people from both areas founded also the West Eastern Divan Festival. It's a festival where you can show cultural events dedicated to both parts of the world as a new declaration of love to the Islamic world. Goethe did the first declaration, and now the people interested in these fields are the followers.
And German writers continue to embrace the spirit of the divan. Silke Scheuermann and Matthias Geritz.
For German writers, it's real, can be very thankful to Goethe, because we have this Goethe Institute which makes us travel to the whole world. And those programs are called West Östlicher Divan. Well, we also have a Hurhaus near the yeah, in the city, which is called West Östlicher Divan.
That's in Brussels, yes. Yeah, yes.
And they do readings too with poets. So there's a crude mixture of guests there.
It's well, this is maybe taking the metaphor of the divan a little too far. And under the name West Östlicher Divan, you have really an exchange program of translating and meeting. German poets are meeting Arab poets. They're going to their home countries. I was in Rabat for a longer time.
I was in Beirut.
You were
yes.
in Beirut, you know. And you are bringing back those experiences. You are working together on translations. So actually you are keeping up the spirit of Goethe's West Eastern Divan, basically.
Yes.
Those who know themselves and others will realize here, too, that the Orient and the Occident have become inseparable.
All human cultures produce a kind of formal poetry. Goethe's West Eastern Divan poems are a tribute to and an embodiment of the kind of dynamic cross-cultural traffic that can open an enormous doorway onto our wider cultural past, a fusion in formal verse that helps us think about our present and imagine a future.
Goethe and the West Eastern Divan was presented by Paul Farley. The translations were by Martin Bidney and David Luke. The readers you heard there were Robert Blythe and Susie Riddell, and the producer was Emma Harding. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, and what a performance in prospect. Daniel Barenboim and the West Eastern Divan Orchestra will play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Well, now that we're more than halfway through this Beethoven cycle, it's a good time to think about what kind of Beethoven is emerging from Barenboim's interpretations and the performances of his orchestra, whose members are coming on stage to more applause at the Royal Albert Hall. I've never seen an orchestra so well and generously applauded so consistently by the Royal Albert Hall Prom's audience. I'm struck listening to these performances that there are things that Barenboim seems to be doing that have a kind of weight of tradition that might go back as far as Wilhelm Furtwängler, who was such a big influence on him. But there are things also that Herbert von Karajan might have done, and then, strikingly, things from a more modern kind of performance practice, the sort of transparent textures that Nicolas Arnicourt or John Elliott Gardiner even gets. Enough about what I think, though. Let us know what you reckon to it all. Get in touch on Twitter at BBC Proms. And here now is just a wee taste of the man himself on the roots of his approach to Beethoven in conversation with Proms director and BBC Radio 3 controller Roger Wright last week.
These are works, of course, that have accompanied me all my life. I still believe that I learned to think the music in Furtwänglerian terms, but without in any way being critical of him or thinking I know better. I don't mean that way at all. I've tried in the last 5 to 10 years to see whether a lot of the abrupt changes and transitional changes that he did so inimitably, wonderfully, could not be done just with the change of color, with the change of balance, with more emphasis on the harmonic changes rather than on with extreme changes of tempo. And I think that the musicians in the orchestra today have the technical capacity, and in this orchestra, the musical ability to think that one can make this experiment.
Daniel Barenboim. Okay, so Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Well, it starts with the most famous four notes in music history. which were the call sign for Allied victory during the Second World War. It also sets a new template for the possibilities of instrumental composition. It's an existential journey from apparently unstoppable tragedy in the opening movement to the unclouded triumph of the very end of the piece. It's a symphony that's become a symbol of heroism, of victory over struggle, of Beethoven's belief in the transcendent abilities of mankind and humanity's propensity or possibility to better itself. All that and a performance we're about to hear from musicians from the most conflicted geopolitical region in the world. Well, one thing's for sure, this that you're about to hear will not be a hackneyed run-through of a musical war horse. It should be about to shake the Royal Albert Hall to its foundations, and you at home too, into a transfigured sense of joy. Now, okay, I'm giving this performance quite a lot to live up to, but I don't know, based on these performances that we've heard so far from the West Eastern Divan Orchestra and Daniel Barenboim, we ought to be in for something special. Now, Barenboim talked about the way that Furtwängler manages the transitions, and that, I think, is the real secret about what he's trying to do with this orchestra too. He's always about connecting one idea to the next. Now, in this piece, you could see that the whole thing has to connect from the very first notes that you hear, those first four notes, to the final blaze of glory with which the symphony ends. And if there isn't a seamless line going from one to the other, then this symphony isn't going to work. That's the challenge that Daniel Barenboim and his orchestra are about to go on. This, the biggest orchestra, or the biggest scale the West Eastern Divan Orchestra have been in this series so far, 16 first violins, 8 double basses, double woodwind, and the trombones and piccolo and contrabassoon waiting for their appearances in the finale. So here comes, on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, Daniel Barenboim to conduct the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Beethoven's C minor symphony, number 5.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
an astonishing reception for that irresistible force of nature of a performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. He shakes the front desks of his string section, he gestures to the rest of the orchestra, many of the audience, the Prommers are of course already on their feet, many of the rest of the audience are too. Daniel Barenboim turns and faces the Royal Albert Hall audience. It's a piece that's absolutely inscribed into the DNA of the Proms and the BBC Proms. The Fifth Symphony was the very first Beethoven symphony to be heard at any prom in the first season in 1895. And as I talk to you now, it's also the last Beethoven symphony to have been performed at the BBC Proms. You may have noticed at home that the piccolo solo in that final movement was maybe unduly... it was maybe unusually prominent. That's because the player was standing up. She stood up for that solo just before the coda. A performance full of those extreme colours that Beethoven finds from this orchestra. That is the loudest sound that had ever been created by humanity in 1808. The biggest orchestra, three trombones, the timpani, the contrabassoon, the piccolo, and a huge string section, and four each of the woodwinds too. Hard really to know what can follow that. Well, thankfully Beethoven did, and tomorrow night I'll be with you for a concert of Beethoven's 7th and 8th symphonies as Daniel Barenboim continues this Beethoven cycle with the West Eastern Divan Orchestra and a performance of Pierre Boulez's En Thème Deux, played by Daniel Barenboim's son Michael Barenboim. For now, as Daniel Barenboim comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, still accepting this rousing acclaim from the audience here and his orchestra too. Somebody else who knows how to follow it is Ian Skelly back at Broadcasting House. Time now to hand you on to him for the rest of this evening's programming here on BBC Radio 3.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. What a responsibility. Tom Service at the Royal Albert Hall with tonight's rather exciting BBC Prom. And if you caught the tail end of that concert and you'd like to hear it all, then you can go to the Radio 3 website and navigate your way to the Listen Again pages, where it's going to be available for the next 7 days. Although if you'd like to hear it on the radio again, then do tune in to Afternoon on 3 this Friday night afternoon from 2 o'clock, and you can hear the concert in full once more. Well, as Tom said, we're back there at the Royal Albert Hall to hear yet more from the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Daniel Barenboim guiding them through two more of Beethoven's symphonies, the 7 and the 8, tomorrow night, plus more Boulez. That concert begins at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, because we have two proms tomorrow night. A concert by the Kronos Quartet will be on later. They have, for the last 40 years, effectively been reinventing the string quartet, turning the form into a multimedia event. Well, tomorrow you can hear them playing high-octane Syrian folk pop in tomorrow night's prom, which ends with the world premiere of a BBC commission, inspired by the work of the pioneers of electronic music, who made up the staff of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. That's our late prom tomorrow night at 10. Well, back to tonight, and in just over 5 minutes' time, the next in our summer series of Lebrecht interviews. Norman Lebrecht talks at length to leading musicians and musical figures, and tonight the pianist Menachem Presler is in conversation, reflecting on his long and distinguished career, not just as a concert pianist, but also as one of the founders of the Beaux-Arts Trio. You can hear that conversation at 10. Thank you. That was Tatiana Nikolaeva playing two of the intermezzi, Schumann's Opus 4. Well, this is BBC Radio 3. A very good evening to you. It's now just after 10 o'clock. And in 45 minutes' time, the first of our series of essays this week, exploring the relationship between fatherhood and artistic creativity. That's at 10:45 this evening. But next tonight, time for the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Menachem Pressler founded the most prolific piano trio of all time, the Beaux-Arts. 53 years, 6,000 performances, covering the entire known repertoire for piano, cello and violin. Over time, Menachem became the world's premier chamber music coach, teaching everyone from startups to top stars. Aged 88, he's one of very few musicians to be universally recognized by his first name and universally loved. Menachem Pressler was born in Germany, escaped to British Palestine in 1939, and was launched in 1946 by winning a Debussy competition in San Francisco. He formed the Beaux-Arts by chance after being asked to record some Mozart trios. He outlasted his original partners, Daniel Gillet and Bernard Greenhouse, and several more. Since 1955, Menachem has taught at Indiana University, grooming many prize-winning students and acting as lifelong mentor to the Emerson Quartet. The top conservatories call him in for tone-up sessions. Affable, energetic, and possessed of an infallible memory, Menachem will cheerfully chat through the night in five languages if he likes the company. We meet at the Aldborough Festival, where he's teaching and performing. Menachem Pressler, so good to have you here. Is this a first for Aldborough? Was there ever a Britain connection?
No. I actually remember that the trio was at least twice here to play and to teach, and I was twice more just to teach.
You weren't here in Britain's time?
No. To my dismay, I never met Britain. I am deeply regretting, especially since I now know his music better. Mm. I wished I would have inspired him or wanted him to write a trio.
I've excavated the history of Magdeburg back to the Ice Age, and I found that the only notable musician born there before you was Georg Philipp Telemann in 1681. It was not a very musical place that you grew up in.
In a way, Magdeburg was a musical place. Wagner was a conductor at the opera.
But no musicians, from Telemann to you, nobody. Was there music in your family before you?
None. There was music in my family from my father, who had a beautiful voice, actually, and played badly the violin, but with great love, and took us to concerts and took us to... I wanted to study the violin, since my father did, and my brother was studying the piano. Only each time the piano teacher would come, he would be tired, and I took the lesson. So pretty soon I played both instruments, and they said, you have to stop, we can't have you do both instruments, you've got to go to school. And so I decided I would do the piano. But Magdeburg itself, when I remembered it most sadly. I remember the Kristallnacht, I remember being frightened in a darkened apartment, hoping that no one would come upstairs. Our store was devastated that night and broken into. And I do remember all that, and you know how life is. I became an honorary citizen of the town of Magdeburg.
They've made you an honorary citizen.
They made me an honorary citizen.
From 1933, when the Nazis came to power, until 1939, when you left, were you able to continue music lessons?
Oh, I could take music lessons in the end only because the man who taught me, he was an organist at a church. His name was Mr. Kitzel, and he was wonderful. I couldn't go anymore in the tramway to his apartment, because Jews were not allowed to go in the tramway. So he came to the house and taught me. It was forbidden for him.
Yeah.
He did that, and it was something I will never forget. His kindness, his warmth, even when I went, when the family went officially to Trieste, and that's how we survived, because yes. Germany went into the war, it was 39.
Yes.
He sent me music to Trieste, with fingerings. It's unbelievable, yes.
The decision to leave, was that from one day to the next? Or?
You see, the decision to leave, my father long wanted it, but my mother never wanted it. Even on the to go to the train station on the day when we left, she was late. But she came and we were together. And so we stayed in Trieste together in a place, you know, which was, of course, at that time filled with refugees. Now, the only place where you didn't need a visa was in China.
Shanghai,
where you needed just a ticket on a boat. But the tickets on a boat were sold out 5 years, 6 years in advance, all the boats. And Switzerland, when you tried to smuggle yourself in, they took you into a camp. Luckily, we received the visa or the certificate to go to Palestine, and the boat didn't even get back because it was a Galilee. Italy went into the war when we arrived. I actually have a friend, a very close friend from Magdeburg, who stayed in Trieste and was taken to a concentration camp that way. It's unbelievable. God works in miraculous ways, yes.
So you, your brother, your sister, your parents, you're 14 years old, you arrive in Palestine.
Yes, not knowing.
Knowing nothing and no one.
Nothing. And my father then with his brother had for the beginning a grocery store. At midday, I was bringing the food to people who had bought it on a bicycle.
You were a delivery boy?
I was a delivery boy.
And you did this during school or?
School and practice.
Right.
I started really then to practice and the school, but it was the practicing which was. The only thing was I wasn't well, but I didn't know it. My father thought that, oh, those are the allures of a young gifted fellow, because each time it came to a meal time, I couldn't eat. And of course, you imagine what happens. You become thinner and thinner. The doctors then, when they saw me like that, they sent me to Malia Hamishal through a place.
A kind of health farm.
To get better.
In the Jerusalem hills.
It was next to Jerusalem, yes. But I do remember my piano lessons, which was very important.
This eating disorder, which is what we would call it nowadays, was this some kind of post-traumatic shock, do you think, of being forced into exile?
I would say yes. Now, my daughter became a psychologist. Mm-hmm. A doctor in psychology. Now, when I think back, not ever gone to a psychiatrist, psychologist, never, that was the disorder of this enormous change in language, change in eating, change in environment. You know, the Italians bombed Tel Aviv. I listened to the radio
in 1940.
It came in Hebrew, and it came in English, and it came in Arabic, and I was waiting, now it has to come in German.
Because you couldn't understand any of them.
it wouldn't come in German. So that change was very dramatic, and I guess I reacted to that. What helped me? Music. You see, I played with a kind of, I know that I fainted in a teacher's lesson. I was so involved with the music, and then the next thing I see cold water over me and all this. That was actually my treatment, my healing. the music. I will give music, not only did it beautify my life, not only did it give a reason to my life, but it saved my life.
And you've never stopped eating since?
No.
Your teacher in Tel Aviv was Leo Kestenberg.
No, to begin, it was Eliyahu Rudyakov. And Rudyakov was a wonderful man. He was handsome. He was Russian-born. Came with his family to Palestine. Studied in Germany with Max Power in Leipzig. Mm-hmm. Met a German girl, took her with him to Palestine. Then after he thought that's as far as he could go with me, he sent me to Leo Kestenberg.
Kestenberg is this phenomenal figure. He's a legend in German culture. He was head of music at the Prussian Ministry of Arts throughout yes. the whole Weimar Republic.
Yes.
He's the man who founded the Kroll Oper, essentially the founder of modern opera. Yes. He brought Schönberg, Hindemith, Klemperer to Berlin, and his own teacher, Busoni. What kind of man was Kestenberg?
For me, he was a very spiritual man. First of all, he was enormously intellectual. The whole culture, the whole attitude that he had, and also the attitude to music. Actually, he wasn't really a good piano teacher in that sense, but he was a great music teacher. I actually, for his birthday, learned the Diabelli variation and played it. That was dedicated for him. Also, he was knowledgeable. Literature was open to him. He would read continuously. He took every day a lesson in Hebrew. I must say, you know that Busoni wrote for five people pieces, elegies, and one is dedicated to Egon Petri, who also was one of my teachers. One is dedicated to Kestenberg. So Kestenberg was quite an influence on me in that regard. He also had me walk with him outside to look at the beauty of a tree. You see how beautiful this is here? You never look at that. I never did. Feel it. He was also the one, without knowing actually what he wanted, he would sometimes hit me on the shoulder and says, beautiful sound. Why don't you play beautiful sound? So in a way, he was very instrumental, very important. He sent me to Egon Petri, which was the real pianist mm-hmm. among these people, the Busoni followers, who was not the great artist, but he was really the great pianist and great musician. Mm-hmm. You see me making a difference between pianist, musician, and the artist. The artistry, the one that can change a phrase so that the phrase becomes an unforgettable, an experience. It's not that you admire the wonderful building of a work, not that you admire the wonderful hand work of a pianist, but that for a moment, the world stands still, and it's a phrase that you never forget. Schnabel was capable of doing that, yes. Radulupu at one point or another can do that. Peraya can do it at one point or another. You know, when an artist all of a sudden speaks, not even in his tongue, but in the tongue of the composer, as if he found a way into the, or is connected with his naval court to the naval court of the composers.
And what you're describing is almost a history of music and teaching, that you've gone from a church organist who's rooted in Magdeburg from the time of Bach, Handel, Telemann, through the great classics, then to Kestenberg, who is an associate of Busoni and the embodiment of Weimar culture, through to Steuermann, second Vienna school. You've had really a complete music education.
I am lucky, yes. I'm lucky actually because, no, I forgot one teacher I didn't mention. And I was with her only for 3 months. very important 3 months. Her name was Isabella Vengerova. She was the most feared piano teacher in America. She was a great piano teacher. She represented the Russian method. Lenny Bernstein was one of her students, and I went to study with her. I didn't study any piece, really. Learned the method of using the wrist. You mentioned I won the Debussy Prize, but how did I win the Debussy? Kestenberg didn't know Debussy. He couldn't teach Debussy. To Israel came a pianist by the name of Paul Loyonnais, a French pianist. He had a big success in the recital. He played the second recital, even a bigger success. The Israel Philharmonic invited him to play the Emperor and second Saint-Saëns concerto. He hadn't played with an orchestra. He said, send me a pianist. So I was sent. I played the second piano for him. And he said, that's not bad. What are your plans? What are you doing? Well, I said, I want to go to San Francisco to the Debussy competition. Oh, he said, what do you play of Debussy? And I said, Clair de Lune and the Arabesque. And he started to laugh. He said, I tell you what, bring me tomorrow the first 3 preludes. So I brought him the first 3 preludes on the next day, and he showed me how to read it. He showed me how to play it. I had 6 lessons with him during this time. I learned the Debussy all by myself, but without those 6 lessons, I would have never been able to do it. So, coming back to New York, studying with Vengerova, Loyonnais, on his way to Montreal, where he took a teaching position, comes through New York and calls me and says, Menachem, I'd like to see what happened to you. Come and play for me. I said, oh, with pleasure. I went to Steinway's to play for him. I come to the lesson for Vengerova, and she says, you took a lesson with someone else. I will not teach you. I said, Mrs. Vengerova, I didn't take any lessons. You did take a lesson from someone else. I said, I played for Loyonnais. She wouldn't listen. She threw me out. And I had never got another lesson. But she did give me one of the most important things. She gave me the insight of a new way of touching the piano.
Knowing you, Menachem, you were never going to be the me type of soloist who throws a tantrum when they don't have the right kind of tea in the green room. Was this an inhibition for you in any way on having a solo career? Was this why you gravitated more towards chamber music?
No, not at all. It was an accident, and it was for me a discovery. I mean, look, I was in successful young pianist. Mm. The trio started on a whim. I was recording a lot for MGM Records. Mm-hmm. I said, could I do a Mozart trio? He said, yeah, why don't you get yourself 2 people and make it? But, you know. But here, again, luck played the role, because in the hotel apartment that we lived in...
In New York,
Peter Stuyvesant, Schnabel lived there. And also the first or the second violinist of the NBC orchestra. When I called him, he said, why don't you play with our concertmaster, our first cellist? I said, I don't know them. He said, come tomorrow to rehearsal of Toscanini, I introduce you. So not only did I hear a rehearsal of Toscanini, which was wondrous, magnificent, he did La Mer. And to hear him do tadim padim pampim pampim pampilam pilarim was so wonderful, because he wanted them to play with the freedom of a string quartet, 110 men, yes? It was fantastic. Anyway, I met Gillet.
The concertmaster?
Gillet, and I was playing that week for the first time the Schumann Quintet with the Paganini Quartet. Gillet, when he said goodbye to me, said, you know, you're playing the Schumann Quintet. I played it as second violinist in the Calvé Quartet. I played it as first violinist in my quartet. We played with Courtauld, we played with Casadesus, we played with every one of the great pianists.
He was a Russian who'd been living in France.
Mm-hmm. At that point, his name in the Calvé Quartet was Gilevich. It became Gillet when he immigrated to America. When he coached me in the quintet, it was for me an eye-opening experience. So then we heard by accident Greenhouse playing with Bartlett and Robertson, the piano duet, also recording for MGM, the Saint-Saëns Carnival of the Animals, and him, Greenhouse, playing the swan, the most beautiful swan I ever heard. And they made some kind of a mistake. He did it again, and it was again fantastically beautiful. Anyway, that's how the trio was born.
Let me just say, you're starting up, and it's Daniel Gillet, who's a really established musician with immense pedigree. You're a young soloist,
yeah,
pianist, and Bernard Greenhouse is less well-known. Well, what I'm trying to find out is, was there at the beginning a primus inter pares? Was there one of you who in some way...
Yes, Gillet, without a doubt, of course. Mm. Not only, but not just because he was the oldest, but he was certainly the deepest of the musicians. I mean, Gillet, the rehearsals then when we made the trio were terrible. Every second word that he used because was an insult. Not to me so much as Greenhouse. Greenhouse reacted. I thought I was learning a lot. And then when we played, the chemistry was unusual. When we got the invitation to play in Tanglewood instead of the Albanelli trio, it was a Beethoven fest, a Beethoven program, we accepted.
1955?
Five. 1955, 13th of July. We accepted, we worked like dogs. We come there, Münch comes
Charles to Münch. Greet
Charles Münch, who was the director of the Boston Symphony and of the festival, comes to greet Gillet and says, I'm delighted your group is here. I will stay for the first half, but then I have the Ninth Symphony to conduct tomorrow, the rehearsal, and therefore I will leave early. We played the concert. He stayed through the program. Columbia, instead of giving us seven concerts, make the recording and part. We had all of a sudden 70 concerts in small town. Everything was community concerts, very small town. But it was fantastic because we learned, first of all, to become a trio. The program itself was a trio, solo group violin, solo group piano, intermission, solo group cello, a trio to finish. And the people in this little town said, you know, chamber music is not so bad. They thought the solo pieces are also chamber music. Anyway, it was a wonderful experience to work that out. Imagine, we had to go by car because the fee was so low that if we didn't use a car, we would never have broken even. But we learned to become a trio during these trips. We would be playing seven concerts a week. And it was really unbelievable, the experience that it created. Now,
so you pile into the car after a concert, and Bernard Greenhouse always drove.
Most of the time.
And then you drove several hundred miles.
No, the thing was, the contract says never more than 500 miles. Sometimes it was more than 500.
Because he described driving from west coast to east.
Yeah,
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I don't think the groups today would realize how difficult it was. And don't forget, after the concert, nothing was open. Maybe sometimes there was a machine in the hotel, so we ate some potato chips or things. And nothing fazed us. And then, right about the third year or fourth year, Judson said to me, "You can't be in a trio and solo too. If you want, you can leave the trio." I said no. And that, I think the reason for it was not that I felt I was a chamber musician. No. I only felt that the musical experience, the satisfaction derived there, was greater and was more special, let me put it this way. It was really, of course, then on the other hand, the traveling, the experience was better. You are never alone. I mean, you share the success and you share the defeat.
But there's a lot of friction as well between you. There must have been tremendous irritation of three men living together in a car with instruments.
It's like Greenhouse said in London at the broadcast was the desert island, yes? He said, "We had all the disadvantages of marriage, none of the advantages." Yes, of course there was continuous friction. The friction became continuous because we would listen to music, and Guillet, being an adopted Frenchman, was a French chauvinist. Anything French came on the radio,
the car radio
was perfect. All the other he would criticize.
And you were the peacemaker between
and
them.
I actually, you know that Menachem in Hebrew means the consoler. And in a way, I was the peacemaker, yes, yes. Because to a certain extent, I understood him, and I certainly understood Bernie.
You must have been, through these years, an absentee husband, absentee father, away for long periods.
I was away a lot, yes, of course. And it was an absentee father, and it was an absentee husband. But when you have a wife, like I was lucky, I did not know that I would be lucky like that, who is a comrade, she was remarkable in taking everything off my shoulders to work. She was capable of keeping the children. She spoke to the children always in Hebrew. She forced me to speak to the children in German. They didn't like even to hear my Hebrew. They said the accent was wrong. They who didn't speak it, but they felt my accent was wrong. But anyway, she was the one who, even when she was sick, staying with the children, would always say to me, "Sorg dich nicht. Don't worry. Go. Now, where do you find that?" So I without them, without the support of hers and my children, I would not have had what I had, and I would not have done what I have done.
Did you never think of going back to a solo career, higher fees, more time at home, break up the
you
trio?
Know, a career is not something that you can direct in that way. If you don't do what is offered, then it is not offered anymore. Maybe a Horowitz or not even Rubinstein. After a while, it dries out. A career has a life of its own.
A momentum, yeah.
Like the trio. The trio itself had a life of its own that we participated in. But we thought we directed, but we didn't really direct it. It came always, the impetus came from the outside.
When Daniel Guillet retired after 14 years,
yes.
Was that a shock? Was that a decision-making moment for you?
Yes and no. You know, we decided to take Isikon as a violinist, who he was second violinist in the Juilliard Quartet, mm-hmm. had just left the Juilliard Quartet. It was a big change in a way. The good part being that the trio by that time, Daniel was with us 14 years, the trio's face was formed. Cohen is a wonderful chamber musician, fitted in before using his influence. Of course, he was different. Guillet, being French trained, he was Galamian, Russian trained in New York. He used his influence then because he also was an outstanding musician in many respects. And his passion for music was exemplary. So when he came in, it was not such a break. Much more of a break for me later was when Greenhouse had to be replaced.
When Greenhouse retired in 87, I mean, that was quite a shock, because he gave you very short notice.
That's true. Because, I mean, I knew that he suffered from the heart. I carried the cello. He took these pills every time we traveled. When he had broken his leg, and we played in Berlin with the orchestra, and I carried the cello on stage, and I heard one musician say to the other, he says, "But I thought the little one plays the piano." So, no, when Greenhouse then decided he would take the position in New Jersey, teaching. Mm-hmm. That was a big shock for me and a big change. And
did you think of giving up, or it was still...
No. At that time, I didn't think of giving up, no.
So you
no.
took Peter Wiley as cellist? You didn't tell Bernard Greenhouse until afterwards?
No. You see, a Peter Wiley would never be a replacement for a Greenhouse. Any of the phrases of Greenhouse, I mean, that was not the case. Cohen knew him mm-hmm. from Marlboro, and okay. so I felt the least resistance would okay. be that the two will get along very well. For a while they did, but then they didn't. But anyway, the real resurrection of the trio came at the end when...
Let me give you the chronology here.
Yes.
Isidore Cohen left in 92, and then you carried on with Ida Karfavian, and then on with Antonio Meneses, Brazilian, Young-Ook Kim, Korean, Young-Ook Kim. Daniel Hope, English.
Yeah, no, but you see, Young-Ook Kim was wonderful. Mm-hmm. No, Young-Ook, in the middle of our tour, couldn't play anymore. That's how Daniel came into the trio. And Daniel and Antonio, that was, again, a golden period of the trio at the end.
And Daniel Hope told me to ask you about the coaching session you had in Beethoven, Opus 70, number 2, from the Hungarian composer George Kortak.
It happened that we played his piece. Mm.
Kortak.
No, we were supposed to play his piece. We actually played a piece of a German composer that day. And the next morning he came and he showed us his piece with the pianino and the piano. And then he said there was something in the Ravel trio I didn't like that you played last night. And I said, "No, why don't we play for you the Ravel trio?" He said, "No, what are you playing tonight?" I said, "Tonight we play Opus 70, number 2, Beethoven." And he said, "That I like to hear." And so we played Opus 70, number 2, the first movement. And, you know, without praising myself, I don't think that anyone has played it more often, rehearsed it more, recorded it twice. And I was overwhelmed by the insight that Kortak gave to that movement. I was absolutely overwhelmed. So was the rest of my trio. I mean, Daniel was overwhelmed. So was Antonio. That insight that Kortak was capable of finding.
And he writes pieces for you.
Yes.
Was it a wrench to break up the trio in 2008?
Yes. Yes, it was. in a way, because the trio was doing so well and played so well. You can hear in this film that the Arthur made of my life, they bring the performances of the trio in Lucerne and Tanglewood at the last one. You hear it, it's really on a real beautiful level of playing. But when Daniel told me that he will have to leave the trio because his career was going to...
Solo career.
Solo career was doing so well, which I love, which I'm happy that it was and that it is. I decided, no, I don't want to bring up another violinist because I had to work with Cohen, I had to work with Jan-Hoek, with Ida, but Ida didn't want, but with Jan-Hoek, and then with Daniel. Daniel was absolutely. I decided, no, that should be. And then, although every manager said, please, Menachem, as long as you play, you have as many concerts as you want. But I didn't want that. I really felt if it was at the height, the trio itself deserves that. That it stops at a place when one would look up to it. And then the most interesting part was I never thought that I was known really personally to the extent as it turned out to be.
You were more famous than you knew.
No, you know, it's a pleasure to find out that more people know about you than you thought they did.
You teach around the world.
Yes.
What's your first thought when you see a new student?
My very first thought is, what connects that student to his playing? What connects him to the music he plays? You know, I have found that the one thing that most people need to be also reminded of and taught is the love for the music. You see, most of the time when I hear it is the love for what, look at what I can do. And yes, that is good what you can do, or if you can do something well, fine. But no matter how well you play, no matter how well, it is only well if it's in the service of that which is alive 200 years later, while pianists come and go, and we only remember the great moments. The great moments in music, when they are translated and spoken clearly by an interpreter, are unforgettable. And that's what is the aim, actually, to find that moment. We are all looking for that moment. Okay, in today's climate where cleanliness is a must, recordings that have started with scissors and now you can take one note out at a time, which is unheard of, have created in the listener a consciousness of what is, so to speak, perfect. But what is perfect? Perfect is the composer, who is imperfect too. Look at Beethoven, what notebooks he filled with changes that he made. That, to be able to translate that into an experience for someone who sits in a concert. I have said once, and I believe that my religion is music, is the composer. My Bible is the work. I open a Beethoven sonata, a Schubert sonata, a Chopin piece. And my temple is the concert hall. That's where I feel that which I believe firmly in should be translated and brought out.
I've seen you at work, Menachem, in successive rehearsals of the Dvořák Quintet, with the Emerson Quartet, and with an ad hoc group. You stopped the Emersons at almost every note And the others, with the others, you beamed and told them how good they were.
you know, the Emersons were great, and the wonderful quartet. I coached them to play the pieces with piano 35 years ago, when they started. At the time, the Beaux-Arts Trio was already flying very high. And I was very critical in our relationship in the Beaux-Arts Trio. So, of course, I was very critical in the relationship with the Emersons. But because I admired them and loved them, they responded. And as you know, the first recording, the Dvořák and Quartet and Quintet and Schumann Quartet and Quintet were with me. And to this very day, actually, if you say that I'm very critical, yes, I am, when I see in a group the possibilities. The young Pacifica, I am the kind of mentor for them and do it. And just now, I mean, it is something special when you hear a young group who can do these things. And then I try to transmit that which makes the playing with piano so beautiful. It's not that the pianist plays like I just played, and that was an interesting experience because I adore the young French quartet called Ebene. You know them?
Yeah, Ebene.
One Ebene.
Yes.
One.
Fantastic quartet.
And I played with them just now in Munich a few weeks ago. I played with them the Brahms Quintet. And even the critic noticed, he said, usually the Brahms Quintet is a piano concerto. But here we heard, for instance, every part playing his part. Now, in the rehearsals, I had to point out to them many moments where if you play pianissimo and the pianist can play pianissimo in that place, that will be beautiful. That's what Brahms heard. And that's what should be heard by everybody. Because Povalis played fourth in this place, because he always played with pianists who played loud. In this place.
We once had a competition, you and I, as to which of us had met more people who had known Brahms. The musical past is so rich. What do you make of the future?
I am just reading a book about Brahms again. He is a remarkable composer. What is in him so very strong is his self-criticism. So that he speaks his language. I understand he was very abrasive. He was not a good friend because he could be terrible to the people who were very nice to him, who adored him. He could be sometimes very terrible. But look, he left us with an enormous rich heritage that the language today of Brahms is our daily language. It's even more so than Beethoven, because Beethoven is so esoteric, he goes so far, he goes so deep. Who can go every day so far and so deep? Brahms goes deep and far, and we can go with him. The trip is wonderful with him.
Menachem Pressler, vielen Dank, toda rabba. Thank you very much.
I thank you, Norman. You are very special to me. Very special. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Menachem Pressler talking to Norman Lebrecht. The producer was Georgia Mansmith. And don't forget that the programme's available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download it from there too. Well, Norman is back next Monday when he talks to the Hungarian conductor and co-founder of the Budapest Festival Orchestra, Ivan Fischer. That's at the same time, 10 o'clock here on Radio 3.
On BBC Radio 3, the BBC Proms pays homage to anniversary composer Claude Debussy with one of his most famous works, the masterly orchestral seascape La Mer. And from beneath the waves, a submerged cathedral, Proms founder Henry Wood's orchestration of Debussy's prelude, La Cathédrale Engloutie. Thursday night at the BBC Proms, live on Radio 3 from 7 o'clock.
Well, time now on Radio 3 for our essay. And this week, the theatre director and writer Lou Stein sets out on a quest to understand the long-standing connections between fatherhood and creativity. In The Father Instinct, he's asked two contemporary artistic figures, the painter John Keane and the writer Abdul Razak Gurnah, to offer their personal and strongly felt perspectives on how being a father changed their approach to their work. Well, tonight in the first of the series, Lou Stein himself returns to the classical world to reflect on today's shifting fatherly landscape.
During the early summer of 2006, I was rehearsing a new play by the Irish playwright Brian Friel, and I was expecting the birth of my first child. The first night of the play and my own child's first night were simultaneously rushing towards me. It was a challenging and exhilarating time where both events had reverberations on the other. Performances is Friel's take on composer Leos Janacek's relationship with Kamila Stashleva, a married woman nearly 40 years younger than himself. Janacek was himself married, but it was his charged infatuation with the younger woman which sparked a creative explosion during the last few years of his life, when he was well into his 70s. But he also had two loved children, who tragically both died before reaching adulthood, and I wondered, what kind of father was he? How did choosing to be a father impact upon his work? The most telling piece of evidence I discovered was a pure and simple one. He notated the dying breaths of his daughter Olga, and these notes became music, which are an essential thematic part of his most famous opera, Yanufa. He dedicated the opera to Olga. Though not strictly relevant to Brian Friel's play, which centers on Janacek's passionate liaison with his young muse, this detail nevertheless caught my attention because of my own imminent entry into the state of fatherhood. Both the father instinct and a self-centered artistic instinct lived side by side within him. It instantly made my understanding of the play deeper and more dramatically compelling. Looking at my program note for performances now, 4 years later, I'm reminded of the impact which fatherhood had on the genesis of the play I was directing. It reads, "I'd like to dedicate these 12 performances to my first newborn child, Ethan William Stein, whose recent dramatic entry to the world on May 12, 2006, paralleled the pre-production and rehearsal period of performances. It was a proud and public announcement." There is little doubt that the act of consciously choosing to become a father is a critical choice for any man. But artists who choose to take on the responsibilities of fatherhood have their creative inventions enhanced and challenged in a very specific way. Artist or not, there's no doubt that all of us who have chosen to become fathers live in a consumer-led, technologically-driven age where our roles are hard to pin down and a father's identity in a family is no longer commonly agreed by the society around him. What is expected of us can shift with mercurial speed. In my own case, part of the reason for the delay in becoming a father, though I felt the fatherly instinct strongly throughout my life, was that I feared the negative effect that making that choice responsibly might have had on my work. And so I suppressed the instinct. What I couldn't have imagined is the resonating impact fathering a child would have on my own creative abilities as a theater director and dramatist. With contemporary archetypes of fatherhood in a state of challenging confusion, and having grown up without a father myself, I searched for clues to understanding my new family situation and refreshing my own creative instincts by going back to the basics and rereading the two great pillars of Western dramatic literature, Homer's The Iliad and The Odyssey, seminal works which are themselves the fathers of dramatic literature which followed. Although I couldn't put my finger on it at the time, I was searching for not only new stories to tell, but also for a reminder of the examples of fatherhood which the Greek heroes offered. I had last read them in a first-year classics course as an undergraduate at Northwestern University, and the impact of the stories of the violent 10-year war between the Greeks and the Trojans, and its aftermath, made a deep impression on me. The epic structure of the storytelling inspired me to think about the dramatic potential of prose literature for adaptation to the stage, which was to become a major strand of my professional work. Many years later, my memory of the three central heroes, Ulysses, Achilles, and Hector, was still vivid. I remembered them as military heroes, of course, but their relationship to their fathers and their children became more significant to me as I read through the stories again, in the light of new fatherhood myself. They illuminated with great clarity archetypal interpretations of what it means to be a father. Odysseus, who is the central hero of the Odyssey and also plays a significant part in the Iliad, is the archetypal wanderer hero who is also a committed father. As a cunning advisor and strategist, he was an indispensable key to Greek victory in Troy, an architect of the war-winning Trojan horse. On reading Homer's account of his exploits again, his determined and committed sense of purpose to return to his wife Penelope and son Telemachus, despite the passage of time during and after the Trojan War, strikes me as having contemporary relevance as a father archetype. Within the artistic world, there is particular relevance. The instinct to wander and experience the world, searching for inspiration and keys to creative expression, has always been a part of most artists' lives. Those who have chosen to be a father have to square leaving behind a family for weeks, months, or sometimes years at a time to enrich their imagination and creativity. I realized in my own case, the wanderer instinct prevented me from having the courage to become a father earlier in my life. I didn't trust that I would have the sense of purpose as a father that Homer presents us with through the Odysseus archetype. Just listen to this poetic description of the encounter between Odysseus and his son, Telemachus, when they reunite after a 20-year absence. Odysseus sat down, and Telemachus threw his arms around his noble father and burst into tears. And then both men hugged each other and openly wept, and they wept loudly and more piercingly than birds of prey or hook-clawed eagles, bereft when villagers have robbed the nest of their fledglings. His son, Telemachus, becomes his soulmate and a projection of a happy future working together. Odysseus's instincts are in stark contrast to those of Achilles, the great warrior hero of the Trojan War, who has all the virtues revered by the ancient Greeks, strength, military prowess, and honor. He is a relentless, self-possessed warrior who is humanized by the personal tragedies of the war. Although he is half-god and characterized as the perfect warrior, his success is continually undermined by his human frailties. He's opinionated, argumentative, and his hot-headed temper is impossible for the Greek commander Agamemnon to manage. It is only through the guile and persuasion of Odysseus that he is convinced to fight for the Greeks at all. Like myself, who grew up with no father, he died when I was 7, Achilles was constantly revolted.